Don't know how well you know the story of Elijah, but this is towards the end of his life, I suppose. And in some ways, I thought it would be helpful if we just had a look at all the things that happened before this event. And so we're just going to do that. And we're told, if we start in chapter 17 in 1 Kings, we're told that God said to Elijah, I want you to go to the king, bearing in mind that the king and his wife were not God-fearing people. I want you to go to the king and tell him that unless you change your ways, there's going to be a drought. Now, before then, we know nothing of Elijah. He doesn't seem to come from a royal priesthood family. We know very little about him. And then suddenly, God says, sorry, I can't see if I look there. That's right. Suddenly, God says, this is what I want you to do, Elijah. And Elijah, in total obedience, goes to the king and says, unless you change your ways, there will be a drought for 7 years. Well, the king doesn't change his ways, and there is a drought. And what God says to Elijah is, I want you to go and hide from the king, and I will look after you. And so the next story that we've got is where he goes to the Kirith ravine, and the ravens come and feed him. Oh, I've got that wrong. Well, okay, can we have another go at another one? That's the one I want, that one over there where the ravens feed him. And he's there for quite a while, hiding from the king, and God is looking after him. And then God comes to him and he says, right, I want you to go to Zarephath now. And Zarephath is outside of Israel. It's actually the place where Ahab's wife Jezebel came from. I want you to go there, and I want you to stay there. And so he goes there, and we can get in the middle one there, that he goes and he sees a woman, and he says, please, will you give me some water and some bread? And the woman says, I'm sure you know the story well. The woman says, well, I've only got enough oil and flour to make one last lot of bread for me and my son, and then we will die. And he says, well, go and make my bread first and give it to me. And that's what she does in complete obedience. She goes, and the bread and the flour and the oil continue. And it's thought that he's there for nearly 2 years. It's incredible, isn't it, to think that God kept him there and in this foreign land, and he ministered to this woman who was not a believer, who had no understanding of Yahweh, the God of Israel. And then the widow's son became ill. If you remember that story, became ill. And of course she blamed Elijah for that. And Elijah took him and raised him, because he died, and raised him from the dead. And she recognized that Elijah's God was the God. And then we come to that well-known story, don't we, of on Mount Carmel. And God says, I want you to go and to show the people that I am God. And so if we have the next slide, we can see that he challenges the Baal priests and say to them, I want you to build an altar, and I want you to worship your God on the altar, and I want you not, because there was something like 400 priests and prophets there. I don't want you to light the altar. I want you to pray to your God, and your God will light the altar. And this went on all day. And Elijah kept going up to them and saying, you're not trying hard enough. Your altar is not alight. Keep trying. Work harder. And they beat them, and they whipped themselves, and they did all sorts of horrendous things to please their God, so that the fire would come down on the altar. At the end of the day, there was no fire. And Elijah got 12 stones and built an altar. And he says, I want you to drench this altar that I've built 3 times with water. And then I'm going to ask my God that it may fire come down. And that's what he did. And we have that wonderful story, don't we, where Elijah just prays to God, and God answers, and the fire comes down on the altar. And he's so excited. I can't imagine what Elijah must have felt like with the wonder of it all. He must have been exhausted, but also so excited with it all, that God had shown such a wonderful thing. And he rushed off in front of King Ahab to tell the wicked Queen Jezebel. He ran in front of the chariot. He was faster than the chariot. He was so excited to see what her results would be. And the results are, as it was read to us, was that when he got there, nothing changed. Nothing changed. King Ahab and Jezebel still refused to see that the Israelite God was the God. And Jezebel said to him, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them." And he suddenly changed from being this wonderful man who was so full and so inspired by all that God had said was out there without a shadow of a doubt, gave it his all. He suddenly changed to this man who was frightened of a queen who threatened him by some gods who he had already proved had no power. And what he did, he ran away. He ran away from his gods. Having had 3 years or more of listening to God, obeying him, trusting him, he ran away. And why did he do that? Because I think he'd taken his eyes off God and the power that he had, and he put them on human beings. You see, King Ahab and Queen Jezebel had already taken their eyes off God. In fact, they'd never had their eyes on God. And in that verse that we read, we were told that Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done. There was no mention in that verse of anything that God had done. They put all the credit on that one man, Elijah the prophet, who was a nobody, who we know so little about, apart from these few stories. And they said that was him. He did this. He did it. And Elijah, I don't know what he expected. I think his hopes must have been dashed. I think he thought, this is it. This is the final victory. They will see, the people will see, that you are God. They will turn from their ways. They will repent. They will be sorrowful for all they've done. They'll destroy all the Baal or altars. They will destroy all the prophets. And they will come back to you. And none of that happened. Instead, he looked at himself and he looked at this evil queen who had done such horrendous things in Israel. And he became afraid. And so God guided him, if you like, and he went into the desert where he found the broom tree. And he wanted to die. He'd had enough. What's the point of it all? I might as well die. I've been a failure. Nothing has changed. And I love this story because God didn't come to him, rebuke him and say, "What are you doing here?" Not at that time, and I don't think it was a rebuke anyway. God didn't challenge him or rebuff him. He just came and fed him and loved him, sent a messenger until he felt better. And then once he was a little bit better, he said, "Leave the desert and go to Mount Horeb." That was the mountain, you know, that Moses received the Ten Commandments, a really sacred place, a really sacred place. And God said, "Go there. Continue resting and go there." Now, I don't know if you're like me, but sometimes when you're a bit down or you hear things going on, friends or whatever may go away to a conference, or they might go to a meeting, or they'll go to a holiday home and they'll come back and they'll tell you wonderful things that have happened, and you'll think, oh, if only I'd have gone. If only I'd have gone to that conference and had that wonderful blessing. If only I'd gone to that holiday place and really been able to relax and enjoy myself. If only. But Elijah went to the mountain where God gave Moses the Ten Commandments, where the burning bush. Wow, what a place to go. What a place to be sent. Surely, surely Elijah would feel the presence of God in that majestic place. No, he didn't. And he went into a cave and he hid. Do you know, I was reminded really of the story that we read of Jesus when he was tempted in Matthew. And you know it well, I know. Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. And the tempter came and said to him, if you're the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread. And Jesus answered, it's written, man shall not live on bread alone. And then the devil took him to the holy city and stood him on the highest point of the temple. If you're the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift up their hands so that they will not strike your foot. And Jesus answered, this is written, do not put the Lord your God to the test. And again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give you, he said, if you will bow down and worship me. Away from me, Jesus said, for it is written, worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve him. See, I think there's something about us that craves for the wonder and the signs and the miracles and the big crowds and the large numbers and all of that. There's something about us in each of us that wants to be there with that. And that's what the devil was tempting Jesus with to a degree. If you do these miraculous things, the world will worship you. And it isn't like that, my friends, is it? Actually, God doesn't need to be in the large, in the miraculous, in the sign. Yes, he can be and is, but he doesn't need to be in those places. God meets us in a moment, doesn't he? So he can meet us today. He can meet us when we're having coffee. He can meet us in the car park. He can meet us when we're going for a walk. God can meet us in a moment that he chooses. He doesn't need to meet us in the glory, the spectacular, the wonderful. God can meet us wherever we are. And so God says to him, when he went into the cave, when he was on Mount Horeb, and still didn't see the presence of God in the wonder of all of that, God said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here? And it's a bit like, I guess for me, I don't know, because obviously commentaries, books have different opinions. But for me, it's a bit like a mother saying to its child, you've got yourself in a bit of a mess. Come here and we'll sort it out. But first of all, the child has to recognize the mess that it's in. What are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here? And I think God often asks us that question. When we're working for him, perhaps our eyes aren't totally on him. And he says, what are you doing here, Vivian? What are you doing here? Is this about my glory? Or is this about your glory? And what was Elijah's answer? He ignores totally There was no soul searching from Elijah. No sitting down, oh, yeah, maybe I need to think about it. No soul searching. So what does he answer? First of all, he answers in anger. And he says, I've done everything right. I've been so zealous for you. I've worked so hard for you. I've given you everything you've asked of me. Every inch of my being, I've worked for you. I've done it all. Do you know life gives us all sorts of blows, doesn't it? That are often hard for us to take. Could be within our families, could be within our work, could be within our friends, could be within our churches. And sometimes we don't know whether we're going or coming. And the world seems to have gone crazy and upside down. And it's everybody else's fault bar mine. Because that's true, isn't it, anyway? My friend Elvina will tell you that's so true. But it isn't, is it? Because it's usually our fault. And that's what Elijah is saying. I've been zealous for you. You couldn't have asked me to do more. I couldn't have given you more. I couldn't have worked harder. I couldn't have been more spiritual. I couldn't have been more understanding of what the problem was. I couldn't have done more. And it hasn't worked, Lord. It hasn't worked. What do you want me to do now? That wasn't what God was asking. And then often, you know, when we get stuck in a corner, we come defensive, don't we? And in our defense, we then blame other people. And in our defense, we exaggerate and we look at the negatives instead of the positives. So he says, well, I'm the only one left. I've worked so hard and there's only... And that wasn't true. Because if you read the previous chapter, he met Obadiah, who was one of the king's servants. And Obadiah was sheltering, protecting over 100 prophets from the queen. So it wasn't true that he was the only one left. There weren't many. But he wasn't the only one. There were others. I wonder how much in your work for God you feel as if you're the only one doing the work in the church, in your community, in your neighbourhood, in your family. If I stopped, the whole thing would collapse. And that's what Elijah said. Well, I'm the only one left and they're trying to kill me. And he thought, not going to work. Nothing's going to happen. Your people are not going to come back to you, Lord, because once I'm dead, that's it. That's what he's saying. So he was full of self-importance. He'd taken the risks. He understood the risks that he'd taken. He was happy with them. He knew what they were about. But at the end of all, he became worn out, isolated, and frightened. And so God gives him his reply. And this is the reply in verse 11. He says, go and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord. See, God was there all the time, but Elijah could not find him. But he was there. Go and stand on the mountain. And as he stood there, God brought about a powerful wind. But Elijah couldn't see God in the wind. God wasn't there. And then he brought about an earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire. And Elijah couldn't find him in any of those things. And then we're told, after the fire came a gentle whisper. And Elijah heard it. He heard the voice of God. In the stillness of the moment. He heard the voice of God in the stillness of the moment. And when he heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face, went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Now you see, I find that puzzling and I searched and searched to try and get an answer. But I found that puzzling that God had said to him in the previous verses, go and stand on my mountain. Go and feel my presence where Moses has been, where I gave him the Ten Commandments, where there was the burning bush, where so many wonderful things happened. Go and stand on the mountain. And it seems that Elijah stayed in his cave, because it wasn't until he heard that whisper in the quietness that he came out of the cave. That's my understanding of it. And as I say, I tried really hard to see whether that was right or not. But it seems to me that even though God was giving Elijah instructions, going, this is where you'll find me. This is where you'll find me. You know, sometimes when you're low, spiritually low, and I speak from myself, I suppose, but when I'm really low and things haven't gone quite as I'd hoped or wanted, and friends come up to you and they say, why don't you come and do this? Why don't you come and do that? Let's go and have a time of prayer. Why don't we do this? And because of who I am, I've said, no, thank you. I can sort this out myself. Thank you very much. Go away and leave me to wallow in my self-pity, and I'll be all right, and I'll get there in the end. God said, go and stand on the mountain. And Elijah stayed in the cave. Draw near to me, and I will draw near to you. Psalm 23, verse 3 says this. That lovely psalm, isn't it, that we know so well. Well, I might as well read from the beginning. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. You see, Elijah needed reminding of the power of God, not in the great things that he could do, but in the whispering and the quietness. I read somewhere a quote that said, the quieter you become, the more you hear. And isn't that true? Do you know, on a Monday morning, I go to a Keep Fit class, aerobics. And those of you who have done anything like that, you'll know that right at the end of the class is what we do is we lay on the floor or you sit, depending on where you are. And the instructor says, I want you to start to breathe. Concentrate on your breathing. And gradually you work through your body until all you can hear and all you can sense and all you can feel is your own breathing. In the quietness, you hear your breath. And in the quietness, you hear the word of God. He leads me beside the quiet waters. He restores my soul. Martin Luther King was a lover of the Psalms. And Psalm 118, apparently, was one of his favourite Psalms. And he says, peace cometh in the silence. And that's so true. Peace cometh in the silence. Not through the waging of wars, not through the grand ritzy palaver, but it cometh in the silence. That reminded me of the story in Matthew of where Jesus was approached by Pilate. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied. And when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he gave no answer. And then Pilate asked him, don't you hear the testimony they're bringing against you? But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the amazement of the governor. You see, Jesus' silence spoke more to those people around him than him trying to justify everything that he was doing. And so what does God say? So we've gone through the next three, Kathy. We're on the last slide now. Thank you. So what does God say? God says to Elijah, when he finally feels the power and the presence of God again, God says to Elijah, I want you to go back and I want you to anoint three people and they will carry on the work that you are doing. You see, Elijah, it doesn't stop with you. You're not the only one. And my plans are plans for the future. And I know how those plans will end. God lives in the promises that he gives to each one of us. Those promises are true. Those promises are faithful. Zechariah says, didn't he, in his reading, not by power, nor by might, but by my spirit. And my friends, I think that's what God says to us every day of every moment. It's not in the power. It's not always in the might, in the numbers. But it's in the Spirit of God. I kept laughing when I was preparing for this because 3 weeks ago, my husband and I went on holiday in Derbyshire and there was just the two of us with the dog and we had a lovely, lovely time. Lovely time. It was quiet, it was peaceful, there weren't many people about and we just walked along the Monsall Trail and done other walks as well and didn't hardly see a soul. And it was just the cup of tea for us. It was beautiful. And then last week was manic. This week is manic. And there's me trying to get a preparation about being still before God. And I'm saying, God, I've just got to do this, though, and I've got to do this. And so my timetable was just going round and round and round. And all the time, it was be still. Feel my presence. Listen to my whisper, and you will know that I am with you, because I have the plans in my hand. And walk with me, and you will know those plans. The voice of Jesus hides in the language of silence. A couple of weeks ago, we had 2 minutes silence, didn't we, on Remembrance Day. And that's good. And there's such power in that silence, isn't there? When you stand shoulder to shoulder with someone, there is power in the silence. And that's what Elijah learned in that chapter. There is power in the silence. And God whispers into your heart and wants you to respond. Just have a minute or two of silence while we think of that. And maybe you can come before God in the silence, seeking his voice and his presence before we sing our next song.